Cue Henry Mancini, please. Sunday night, and that means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, where it's 17 degrees going on 3 tonight, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome you to 262nd episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recordings for the previous 261 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com, and look under the Radio Show tab. But in addition to the previous radio shows, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. Once again, that's www.johnmack13.com. Writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mayapack Writers Group, now in its 21st year, at 6:30 p.m. at the Mayapack Library on 6 in Mayapack, New York. More than 100 books have been published by writers from this group. Additionally, on Wednesday, this Wednesday coming, January 23rd, will be the monthly meeting of the group that I coordinate, of the Yorktown Poetry Workshop, held at 6 p.m. at the John C. Hart Memorial Library in Trib Oak, New York. This is the group open to both experienced poets and fledgling ones. People wishing more information on the on any of these items may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail. During the past week, one of the most famous contemporary poets, Mary Oliver, passed away, and she's known not only for her poetry, but for a wonderful book on poetry that she wrote. People that are interested in poetry that might look up some of her works. The next week's show at 7 p.m. Will feature longtime New York television personality Jane Hansen. I hope you'll be right back here next week at the same 7 p.m. Eastern time to join Jane and me. Now to this week's show. As mentioned, the 262nd in the series. My guest is Sonja Greenfield, the editor of the online journal Rise Up Review, the director of the annual Southern California Poetry Festival, and a published poet in her own right. The listeners wishing to join Sonia and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I generally hold call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guests. Okay, so let's get started. Welcome to the show, Sonia.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really exciting.
Well, I hope so. That's good. would you start us off with the poem?
I would, absolutely. I thought maybe I would go ahead and read the first poem in my first book. And it's called Milk Carton Kids. Now you know they were abducted on the way to school, past chain link urban puzzles, robins scrabbling in the median, book bags hanging with the weight of history. We're off the side of a rural road in late spring, where slapped mosquitoes left smears of horse blood, and the churn of a distant John Deere sounded like the log sawing of sleep. Were the teens taken under the lantern of the supermoon by the unused railroad tracks, where flowering quince unfolds pale pink among the blackberry brambles, and wharf rats run the length of cool steel in search of drop chips? Or in the desert, when dusk slips on her silk nightie and the saucers scream like gulls while the aliens shape their ecto like cacti, go green and prickly. The extraterrestrials tap their feet to snap on high beams, but we call them stars. Up the kids go as your radio loses its tune, the television becomes a box of static, and the digital clock blinks five again and again, not stuffed in a trunk, not dragged from a lake.
Wow. That's powerful, and it seems to be, as with so many things, it's reminiscent of things that we never heard about, maybe in the days of before the internet. They didn't get the publicity that they do now, but there just seems to be so much more kidnappings, sex trafficking, things that I don't remember from years ago. Was there anything in particular that cause you to write that? Was there any kidnapping that you noticed or anything?
No, I think part of it is that I sometimes will write what I think of as revisionist poems, where there's maybe a terrible story that's lingering in the American consciousness that I like to reframe with a less terrible ending, as a way to, I don't know, both tap into the empathetic web that links us all together, and maybe flip things on their head a little bit, and try to. I don't know, make the world better with poetry, I guess.
That's what hopefully we all do. Let's go to your history now. Where did you grow up, then go to early school?
I grew up in Peekskill, New York, which I think you're probably familiar with. My family, when I was in like kindergarten through second grade, lived in Verplank. And then we moved to Peekskill, and I finished my schooling out there and graduated in 1988 from Peekskill High School. And then I took a few gap years where I worked in retail and tried to figure out what I was doing with my life. And then I enrolled myself in school at Westchester Community College.
Do you remember what your earliest aspirations were?
well, let's see, my earliest aspirations were probably to be a private investigator because I cut my teeth on a lot of mystery. You know, I was reading Agatha Christie one after the other when I was like 13 years old. And so that was probably, and even before that, it was Nancy Drew. So I was like, well, you know, this will be my vocation. But then when I got older and really thought more realistically, I figured I'd get into the animal sciences and do like zoology or marine biology. And in fact, when I started school at, when I was at WCC, I took care of a lot of my general education requirements. But then when I transferred to San Francisco State University, I was taking some animal science classes and some writing classes. And I probably got started with writing or got interested in writing at Westchester Community College. So then I got to
But you're way ahead of me.
Are
we an early reader?
I was an early reader. I got started early, and I used to check out Nancy Drew mysteries from the Peekskill Library when I was 9 and 10 in huge stacks of yellow spines. And they actually, reading helped me get through a lot of tough things in my childhood. But that, a lot of people have that story, you know. We would turn to books when we were turning away from everything else.
How about your years at Peekskill High School? Did you write for a school paper or the literary journal or anything?
No. When I was at Peekskill High School, I read books on my own, but I never participated in school in any way that would be considered academically appropriate. I barely graduated. I had to go to summer school in my senior year, even for English. I didn't bother to walk the graduation line. I didn't turn things around until I enrolled myself at WCC.
How about another poem?
Sure, I would love to. So let me turn to it. And it's called Nafsocrates Considers Bruegel's Famous Work. So just a little framing for this. When we think about the story of Icarus and Daedalus, nobody has ever heard from Icarus's mother. And I feel like part of the history of humanity is that terrible things happen, tragedies happen, but nobody ever gets to hear from the mother about those tragedies. And so I wanted to put a voice to that in the context of this myth. And it's also it's an ekphrastic poem in that it brings up the painting Landscape with the Fall of Icarus by Bruegel. Or Bruegel. You know, part of the thing about growing up and reading a lot but not necessarily engaging in conversation is that sometimes you don't know how to pronounce words. So I've heard it pronounced Bruegel or Bruegel. And I don't know if if Icarus's mother's name is pronounced Nafsocrates, but that's what it looks like it would be. So Nafsocrates considers Bruegel's famous work. I told Daedalus to watch him, goddammit. So now here I am waiting for my son to breaststroke home to me, held up on fingers of green foam. Waiting past the rise and fall of Rome through to Peter's brushwork, which rendered the sun like a lemon on fire, some stupid plowman hogging the canvas, the plunge just a few flicks of horsehair in ochre. I have waited until the ship's sails became rags, until metal replaced wood, motors replaced oars. I said, you can't trust children to make good choices, so watch him. Do you see how Peter painted the toes pointed to the sky? I taught my boy how to dive like that. Every summer day until his teeth were chattering and lips tinged purple, he learned crawl and kick. Trembling over the water like a bent marigold, he learned how to tip into the cold tarn, hands in prayer and head first, my minnow cutting again and again through the blue. Let the seas dry to muddy puddles, let the wheat fields go to dirt. My God, what's a mother to do? I'm leaving on my porch light. I expect Icarus home soon.
I like that. I think that's terrific.
Thank you.
The Wild in Peekskill, you worked at a bookstore in Jefferson Valley Mall where I spent much too much money. How long were you there?
Well, I started my bookstore odyssey at the Westchester Mall, at the B. Dalton there, and then I transferred to the one at the Jefferson Valley Mall. I think it was probably, you know, my earlier history is a bit muddy in my memory, but I was there for, I worked for B. Dalton for many years and was there until 94. And then when I moved to San Francisco, I stayed with B. Dalton for a while still then. So I was, I don't know how long I
remember
at the Jefferson Valley Mall, but there for a while.
I didn't remember one in the Westchester Mall, just not the Cortlandt Town Center. There was a small bookstore there when I moved up. Mm-hmm. And then when the mall went up, there was both the B. Dalton and there was the Walden. And I remember in the B. Dalton, there were three short women about the same size. One was a manager, and there was another one who I still see at the Barnes & Noble. She kind of waddles a little. They were, and the manager also went to Barnes & Noble when B. Dalton went away, and then she transferred about 3 years ago to be managing another store. And it was another woman with dark hair and with glasses that works around the corner from the Barnes & Noble and the home store. So they're still around, I know. And then, of course, B. Dalton, after it was acquired by Barnes & Noble, it was eventually went away. You mentioned WCC a number of times. Both Barbara and I have, my wife have taught there. Barbara still does. I'm on the roster for the last 2 years, but my courses haven't gone. But I taught there years ago. Both of us taught computer things. My more recent courses have to do with blogging and promotion and using the internet to promote things. But it's just a wonderful place because an awful lot of people have gotten their first dragged into education, or they've dragged themselves in, and they've gone on after that. What made you start school again after being out of it?
I was in this place when I was, so I started school when I was 22 at WCC. So I know people who were, now I know people who were graduated by the time they were 22 and getting started in graduate school. But I was working in retail for a while in Westchester County and didn't know what I was doing with my life, but knew that I wanted to do something else besides that. And it just seemed like I was dating somebody who was in college, and all of his friends were in college. And I got to see that they were learning things on their terms. High school was always learning things on other people's terms. So I was just like, well, I gotta go to college, and I filled out the paperwork and got the loans and got started because I knew that that was what I needed to do if I was going to, if I was going to get out of working in bookstores. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I just had this sense of like I wanted something more. Like I wanted to not struggle and live paycheck to paycheck, you know. So I became a poet. Sorry, that's the joke.
Right.
There, yeah. Anyway.
There's a cartoon that's been floating around the internet because of the strike, and it's parents with a kid, and they say, we know that you want to work for the federal government, but would like you to have something with more stability, such as being a poet, which I think is a great line. What made you go west?
So I probably did about 2 years of college at WCC. I was working full time while I was going to school, because that's kind of how you have to do it when you're doing it on your own. And my boyfriend at the time had visited San Francisco a few times, and we started sort of dreaming about going west, and was at a time in my life when there was kind of no reason not to. I mean, San Francisco was affordable in 1994, and what better time to have an adventure in one's life when you're not attached to anything? So that's what we did. We just packed up our car and threw some stuff in a truck and moved to San Francisco. And then I transferred to the B. Dalton there. So, I mean, I had a job.
And once you got into college out there, you mentioned it was both science and writing. How much writing did you do in college there?
Well, to go back a little bit, the writing class that I took, a writing class that was like honors writing at WCC, and I think it was with someone, again, my early memories of life are a little hazy, but maybe a Dr. Costanza. Does that sound like somebody who taught or teaches at WCC?
I wouldn't really know, because my original thing was in computer science. Now I'm teaching in the more adult ed, and I'm also teaching at this, I don't know whether they even had it when you were there, this Pigskill Art Center. It's mainly for writers and for artists and for graphic artists. So I'm teaching there.
Yeah. But yeah, that's after my time. But at any rate, so when I got to San Francisco, I already had an interest in writing. And so I enrolled in both writing classes and animal science classes. But my very first semester at San Francisco State University. And then 2 weeks into the semester, or a week into the semester, I was so jazzed by the writing classes that I dropped the animal science classes and enrolled in two more English classes, and at that point decided that my major was going to be creative writing.
When did you begin writing for publication? And what was the impetus?
Well, I guess I started sending work out maybe as I was finishing my creative writing degree. My very first publication, trying to think, I have it here, was 14 Hills, which is the San Francisco State University Literary Mag. And that was the fall winter of 1998. So I was probably finishing my BA in creative writing at the time. And what is the impetus to send work out? I think we write because we're trying to connect with the world, and so you seek publication so that you can put this poem out there as a way to communicate with other people who may share similar experiences. Just like when we turn to read certain things, it helps us connect to the greater world at large.
It's interesting. I've thought a bit about this. Then long before I got into poetry, I wrote for for magazines and for papers about technology. And then I've written some fiction and then the poetry. And with the nonfiction, it was because I knew something that I wanted you to know, because I thought that was important what I knew, and particularly since it was about how technology was changing the world, how to be competitive, everyone ought to know this. With the fiction, it was because I grew up in a beer-drinking Irish Catholic boss storytelling environment, and I had stories I wanted to tell. But with the poetry, it was more that I was exploring myself, and I hope that you like what I write, but if you don't, I really don't care, because I was exploring things that maybe that I hadn't touched before. Now, have you seen, since you've done different kinds of creative writing as well as the poetry, do you see any differences in where your impetus for a particular thing comes?
So I've written some stories too. I've published a few stories, and I think the interest there is to entertain, I suppose. You know, like I think about some of the short stories that I've read that have stayed with me for my entire life, and the way they struck me so deeply and in such an emotional way that I wanted to replicate that, to keep that going, to keep that connection. Even though it's fiction, oftentimes it's about that fabric of empathy that links us all together. But certainly to entertain,
yeah.
I think about Julio Cortazar short story called Continuity of Parks, and it's got this incredible twist to the story, and I find that I'm always trying to put a twist in a lot of the things that, not always, but in a lot of the things that I write, and there's that influence there. So I don't know. And then nonfiction, I've written a bunch of essays too. And that really is like, in some ways, trying to offer help, much like you, what you were doing. But like personal emotion, like self-help, like trying to think how to describe it. Like this, for example, let me tell you about this thing that happened in my life, so that if you've had something similar happen in your life, you can say, I'm not alone with this experience. This person has just written about it. And now I'm going to turn around and write about my experience so that none of us have to feel alone.
That's very good. I found that when I was doing nonfiction, that the things I was writing about taught me things that I didn't know, because I had to research what I was writing. And I thought that was also helpful to me, but I was really writing it to explain to other people. When you mentioned short stories, the first one I remember was way back in high school, Every Tree Reformation by O. Henry. And it was just a terrific story about a bank robber who was going straight, but he was on the lam and didn't want anyone to find him. But there was the kid that got stuck in the bank with the time till the oxygen would go away, and finally that he had to, in front of the detective, he had to crack in and to open the vault to get the kid out. As you said in the note to me, you met your now husband while studying at the University of Washington, and then you hopscotched around the country for a bit. Please tell us about those years.
Okay. I was living in San Francisco. I was producing television about video games for a now defunct cable network called Tech TV. And I was writing poetry on the side. I was in a like a weekly poetry workshop. And I, at that point, I thought, well, I'm going to apply for an MFA program. And I applied to like six of them around the country with the understanding that a school could pay me for 2 years to be a scholar. And that was really an appealing concept. You know, I guess in retrospect, one might think of the MFA as a means to an end in terms of career. Now, of course, I know otherwise. But it is really a great opportunity to go and study your art for 2 years. And if you're lucky, you go to a program where they fund you. So I ended up at the University of Washington in their MFA program. And I met my best friends I met in that program. Yes, indeed, while I was there, I was working on the side as a bartender for a little extra spending cash, and met my husband while I was bartending. He was coming into the restaurant where I worked with a girlfriend, and then he started coming into the restaurant by himself, and I said, "What happened to your girlfriend?" He said, "We broke up." So then that night I called my best friend and said, "Oh my God, Michael just broke up with his girlfriend. What do I do?" Because I had a crush on him. And she said, "Well, you have to go break up with your boyfriend." And I did. And then I asked him out because I wasn't really shy about making it known what I wanted. And then we've been together ever since. And that was 2003.
In addition to getting the second master's at the University of Southern California, you taught there for several years. What did you teach?
After my husband and I got married, and I got pregnant with my son, and we moved to Connecticut to have my son, because my family and his family were there. And then from there we moved to Los Angeles. Then from there we moved back to Seattle. And from Seattle we moved to Los Angeles to get away from the weather, because at that point we had a toddler and a particularly gloomy winter in Seattle. And then when I got to Los Angeles, I enrolled in yet another master's program at the University of Southern California called the Masters of Professional Writing. The program is defunct now. It's not around. But part of entering that program was being offered a TA-ship to teach composition in the writing program at USC. And then once the program was over, I stayed on for a couple more years teaching as a part-time lecturer, composition, in various themes.
No poetry?
No, I didn't get to teach any poetry there. I would love to be teaching more poetry.
Speaking of poetry, in addition to your own poetry, which we'll get to in a bit, you edit an online journal and direct an annual poetry festival. Let's take the online journal first, the Arise Up Review. Please tell us about that.
Okay. After the presidential election of 2016, I became very despondent, and I knew a lot of other people who were heartbroken. And I wanted to create an outlet for people to make their anger and their outrage and their sadness known. And so I launched an online journal for the poetry of resistance, poetry of opposition, poetry of protest, however you want to describe it. And I started out with a poem a day, and then as things go, since it was a project I was just doing on my own at the time, it became a monthly journal. And then now it's a quarterly journal.
Okay.
Because it's hard to keep up with the expectations, requirements of running a journal. I have a couple of assistant editors who are really great and really helpful, but I'm also trying to do other stuff like keep up with my own writing and take care of my family and take care of myself and run the poetry festival. So anyway, yes, it's a journal of resistance poetry.
And how big, you mentioned it's quarterly. How large is it normally? How many poems, how many pages, how many websites, whatever you want to refer to it as?
Each month, you know, the homepage is the monthly issue, and there's about 30 poems, anywhere from 30 to 40 poems.
Okay. The annual festival, the Southern California Poetry Festival, runs for an entire weekend. How long has the festival been going? And tell us about it, please.
Okay. Just to preface it a little bit by saying that after I got done, so I was teaching at USC for a while, and then my husband and I moved in with his best friend's elderly father to take care of him in his final years. So that arrangement allowed for me to not need to teach at USC anymore. And I needed a break anyway. I was kind of burning out on the grading expectations. So we moved into this house in Hollywood to take care of this elderly doctor, but I needed something else to do to keep me plugged into my intellectual self, and that was how I ended up launching the poetry festival. I met the president of the Poetry Foundation at a conference, and I ended up pitching the festival to him, and the Poetry Foundation found some funds for me, and we are entering the fourth year of the festival.
And you mentioned it runs for an entire the weekend. Are they panels, or are they mainly, or is it a keynote? How does it normally work?
We do workshops. We do panels. We do themed readings or readings by local presses. And the last one that happened was just this past November, and it was really successful. It felt really good.
So is it normally in the fall then?
Yeah, it's been in the fall the past 3 years.
Okay, terrific. Well, good luck with it for another 25.
Thank you. Yeah, right.
How about...
Unless I burn out on that too.
How about another poem?
I have another poem, yes. All right. This poem is inspired by both The Walking Dead and this idea that when things get really rough and really scary, we turn inward and take care of the people we are closest to. And it's called Women and Children First. When the wind changes direction, smoke shifts from the fires. So sometimes it's burning tires in my face. Other times it's neat. Reader, I have done what I can for you. Gave you my extra cig and taught you how to shoot. Showed you which mushrooms are safe to eat. Even trained you to avoid congregations of carrion flies and the decay they make love to. If food was plentiful, I shared it. If the moon only shone on empty woods or handfuls of bright sequins drummed up by breeze across the lake, we laughed at nothing in particular. Now there's a menace, a madman pulling off each fence board at the rear of the yard, and I'm crouching with you, a few bullets left between us. Reader, I have this child clinging to my leg, his eyes crazed with fear, his sweaty face flecked with dirt. The sounds of splintering wood and hound-like baying make our hackles rise. You look to me for help, but my field of vision narrows, only able to take in the one I would kill to save. I love you, but you know how it has to be. Grab your gun, reader. Run, reader. Lakshmi Singh says the hordes are on the move, and from this point on, you're dead to me.
That's powerful. How long ago did you write it, and do you know what the impetus was?
Let's see. I wrote that probably 2 years ago, maybe. I think the impetus really was I was thinking about the fear and the hysteria that was ratcheting up in our country, and this feeling of people just turning to take care of their immediate families, and the circles in America growing ever smaller, and when it really, really comes down to it, we're going to do whatever we have to do to take care of the ones that are our immediate closest loved ones. And The Walking Dead, like I said.
I have a good friend who's a poet, and her most recent chapbook is really aimed at the reaction to Parkland and to the Connecticut of thing, and she's really everything about that is how do we protect not only our children but all the children, you know, and what's happened to our society. And I think there's both fear and outrage throughout the land.
Mm-hmm.
But.
Yeah. Yes, and that's part of it too. It is about protecting the children.
Your poetry collection, "Boy with a Halo at the Farmer's Market." That's an interesting title. Won a prize in 2014. Please tell us about the title, the collection, and the prize.
Okay, so Cod Hill Press is actually out of Newburgh, and it's part of the SUNY Press publishing family. So it was funny that I was selected for the prize by a press that's basically from my home area, from the Hudson Valley, right? So that was kind of a fun thing. And so it was the first book prize. That was very exciting. And the poem itself, "Boy with a Halo at the Farmer's Market," was me imagining that a halo is also the, you know, the gold thing in old Renaissance paintings to mark someone as holy, right? But also, because my husband is a nurse, we talked about how the thing that they bolt into your head to keep a neck stable after a neck is broken is called a halo.
Yeah.
So I like to think about the double nature of words in general. So I was imagining a boy with a halo, but a different kind of halo, and how blessed someone would be to survive a broken neck. And so that's what the poem is about. I could read that poem if it would contextualize what I'm talking about.
That would be fine if you have it handy, sure.
I do. I may have to turn to it. So yeah, it was really exciting to get that first book prize. You know, that's what a lot of us are striving towards. And then after you get the first book prize, then you have to figure out, well, what about the second book prize? And then how do you keep making books? First of all, how do you keep making books? Like, you just write the poems and then you have to arrange them into books, right? And then after you make the books, how do you get people to want to read them? So certainly the first book is exciting, but then you have to keep working, right?
Yes, you do. And this becomes a frenzy at times. Get them written, get them out the door, you know? Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Oh, there it is, 47. Okay, so the poem is called Boy with a Halo at the Farmer's Market, and it goes like this. The metal halo was bolted into his skull. Little drills secured the scaffold so his bones could rebuild themselves. How truly graced he must have been to survive a broken neck. Someday he'll remember how he had to turn his whole body caged to watch the fruit vendor polish apples. His hair will cover the evenly spaced scars. He'll go to school for architecture, having learned to appreciate girders. He'll come to love the gold leaf halos of medieval art, the flash of the Savior in cracked oils. He may carry himself a little gingerly. He may never ride a horse again, but he'll kiss his wife's neck in a dark theater, taking leisure, blessing each vertebra, one lucky break at a time.
Wow. It's interesting how it's almost the luck of the draw. You mentioned how he was lucky. At the Yorktown Town Board last week, I have to read as at the various town board as being the poet laureate. A fellow told a story. There's a suicide prevention group about teenage suicides. And apparently one of the people, and you probably know this story, being on the West Coast, that had that's an advocate for this, had planned to commit suicide by going off the Golden Gate Bridge, and all of the time getting there, if anyone tried to talk him out of it because he was crying on the bus and everything, he said he wouldn't have done it. And he, on the bus, someone came up to him when he was crying, and they asked him how to get to a certain place. When he got off the bus, someone came up to him, and she said, she's going to talk me out of it. And she asked him to take his picture with her camera. And he went off the bridge, and he broke just about every bone in his body, but he was held up by porpoises. And someone on the boat fished him out, and after a long time in the hospital, he became an advocate. And I'm sure over the years there have been other people who have gone off the Brooklyn Bridge or the Golden Gate Bridge, and they haven't had porpoises there, they haven't had anyone else there, and it hasn't worked for them. They haven't survived. But this fellow did, and he's turned his life around.
And he must feel a huge obligation to give back because of how lucky he is to have survived that. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah. Your chapbook, The American Parable, won the prize 3 years later in 2017. Please tell us about both the prize and the collection itself.
I was writing a lot of political poems, a lot of stuff that was reimagining what was going on in our country, or writing sort of post-apocalyptic poems. And a friend of mine said, well, you should take all this political stuff and arrange it into a chapbook. And I said, well, that's an interesting idea. Sure, why don't I do that? So I did. And I submitted it to the Coal Hill Review Autumn House Press chapbook contest, and it was selected by Heather McNarr as the winner. And it is indeed a collection of what I would say are either overt political poems or more covert political poems. But either way, they're making commentary about the state of our nation.
Are they both available on Amazon or only directly from the publisher?
They're both available on Amazon, yeah.
Okay. You'll send me the URLs and I'll put that out to people.
Sure, absolutely.
Your work has also appeared in a number of prestigious reviews, then also in Bo 10 and the 2018 edition of Best American Poetry. Please tell us about the two bests and any other of the work that you want to comment on.
Sure. When I first got contacted about the 2010 Best American Poetry, I was living in Seattle, and I think the like assistant editor contacted me through Messenger on Facebook because I was a nobody poet. I didn't have like a web presence or anything, any way to find me. So he found me through Facebook Messenger, and Amy Gerstler had selected my poem to be in the 2010 Best American. And I assume she came across it because it was in the Antioch Review along with one of her poems. So she was probably reading her contributor's copy and came across my poem in the same issue. And then for the 2018 Best American, I was contacted by the assistant editor again because Dana Gioia had selected my poem Ghost Ship for the 2018 Best American, and that poem was about the fire that happened in Oakland at the Ghost Ship warehouse.
Oh, yeah. You're presently putting together a collection of prose poems for next year. Have you written much prose poetry before, and what is the attraction of the format?
So the book that's coming out in 2020, that's called Let Down. It's being published by White Pine Press as part of their Marie Alexander series. It's in some ways like it's a memoir that's written in a series of prose poems. And if I were to describe the content, I would say that it's about how my son was diagnosed as on the spectrum at the same time as I lost my fertility. So I had a couple of miscarriages when I was trying to have a second child, and this was all coinciding with learning that my son was autistic. And to try and tell the story didn't feel like it was a linear memoir to be written in paragraphs. It was more like, let me try to piece together the complex feelings that I'm having about these experiences. But also, prose poems felt like a natural choice, because you can editorialize a little bit in prose poems, and they can also be accessible, and this was content that I wanted to be accessible as poetry goes. I don't know, sometimes you pick a form and you don't really quite know what it is that feels natural about it. But as I was working on my way through what I would say is my own trauma, at least in regards to the miscarriages, the prose poem felt right. And that book will be out in 2020. And I hope it helps
my
other
wife
parents.
My wife teaches in a special WCC program that's in conjunction with the Pleasantville School District to provide the life skills in both personal finance and technology for all the 16 to 21-year-old students with autism. I've assumed there are many such programs for children of all ages in Southern California, and I also know there are many degrees of autism on the spectrum. Growing up, it was a disease that we never heard of, or a condition. And could you educate the audience a little on the subject? And do we know any more about knowing the causes of it? Or
I don't feel like an expert that can offer education beyond my own personal experiences. I don't feel like I should be the spokesperson for autism. I don't know that we've come up with any understanding per se of what causes it. I can say that my son is a great kid. He's unusual and fun and strange. I know unusual and strange are synonyms, but also just really charming, and that a lot of the things that people think they know about autism based on their exposure in terms of pop culture and media aren't always accurate. You know, you'll hear things like, oh, well, you know, autistic people don't know how to connect with other humans, or they don't have any empathy or anything. And I would say that my son is actually hyper empathetic. And it can be really emotional for him to be in the world sometimes. And he's an individual, you know. And our hope for him is that as the world learns more about autistic people as individuals, it will become more welcoming to neurodiversities, because someday he's going to step into a job interview or something along those lines, and I want the people that are meeting him to understand that if he's not fitting into a particular mold of what we determine as society is normal, doesn't mean that he has some kind of diminished value as a human. So, I mean, you know, we need neurodivergent people in our culture, is my feeling. And even I really feel like, in terms of the spectrum, how there are some people who are much more profoundly autistic, we need to be exposed to them as a culture as well, because what they do is they teach us empathy. I feel like I beat that word up a lot or overuse it, but the more exposed we are to different kinds of people, the more we learn to open our hearts to people.
Yeah, when I was
that felt like a lecture. My apologies.
No, it's not at all. And I do think, and it doesn't directly relate perhaps to autism, that we are educationally a little more tolerant. I remember when I was doing my second master's at Marist, there was a course during the summer that was on different ways of education, and they were so focused on the way some children have to learn verbally, and some writing, and some can shut up in class, and others scream out, and others do other things, and there was so much talking about this and understanding. And I remember when I was in grammar school, if I yelled out in class, someone would break my fingers. It was one, you know, we only had a set way of education. The other thing that strikes me is that it seems that the terrible diseases that we know about from when we were young or when we were older, the polio and the cholera and the tuberculosis, as they seem to get under control, then all of a sudden we're exposed to HIV and to autism and other things that we didn't know about. And we wonder whether there's this cycle that it will go on forever, that there'll constantly be something new that will put people at risk. I don't know.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of the increased awareness of autism and supposed increase of cases of autism is I don't make a connection with vaccinations, for example, because the science doesn't hold up to that. And I also feel like things like herd immunity and the eradication of polio are more important, I guess, than believing in science that isn't proved and is in fact erroneous. So, and a lot of the increase comes from more awareness. You talk about when we were in school, or when you were in school, when I was in school, there were kids who couldn't get with the program and couldn't get with the status quo, and might have been autistic, but they certainly weren't diagnosed as that because the education wasn't there to diagnose them. And a lot of those people that I grew up with probably fell through the cracks because their full potential wasn't realized, because nobody was saying, hey, maybe that kid is autistic. People were saying, hey,
sure,
there's something wrong with that person.
A close friend of mine has a book out called The Longest Beer Run Ever, and it's about him as a merchant seaman delivering beer to people from our neighborhood that were in combat and Vietnam, just because someone said someone would go buy those guys a beer. Well, in growing up, he was tremendously glib and always with it, and he didn't do well in school at all. He got thrown out of a Catholic high school. He got a GED while he was in the Marine Corps. He eventually became very active in the labor movement. He wound up without the college degree of having the master's from Harvard in public administration. And he found out when he was 73 that he's dyslexic. They never would have picked something like that up years ago. And it's,
mm-hmm.
and those kids would have just fallen through the crack if he wasn't so much of a And so glib, he could have fallen through the crack, as I'm sure hundreds of thousands of other people did, things that they couldn't overcome.
Yeah.
The last week, while talking to Hudson Valley poet Shoah Rice, I quoted Joyce Carol Oates saying that as many people write poetry as read it, and I pointed out that Billy Collins disagreed, are writing more people write it than read it. You had mentioned earlier about, so you became something much more practical, a poet. Being a poet is a difficult way to make a living. Are you doing other work to support your writing, or is the writing a full-time effort?
Well, let me tell you about my unique living arrangements and how it is that I can be a poet right now. So I run the poetry festival, and I get a small stipend it's basically about a week's salary. And I don't make any money from running Rise Up Review, the journal, but I live in a home where I do not pay rent and I do not pay a mortgage. And the story goes that this home belonged to the elderly doctor that my husband and I took care of for a year. And the owner of this home is my husband's best friend, whose father it was that we were taking care of. And after his father passed, my husband's best friend said that we can continue to live in this home until we are ready to move. So it's because we don't pay rent and we don't have a mortgage that I have the luxury of being a poet right now. It's an incredible privilege. It can be lonely and isolating sometimes because I'm not out in the professional world at the moment, but I'm not making a living as a poet. My husband is an ER nurse. He makes a good salary, but we are firmly middle-class folks, and right now we're living on one salary, and it's only because we have a free house to live in, basically.
Most
and
poets
I always
aren't
say
even...
all poets should get patrons like we have.
Yeah, most poets aren't even middle class. They're way down until they finally hit it. What's next for you?
Well, my husband and I are getting a little fatigued by Los Angeles, feeling like maybe it might be time to move. We're restless folks. We like to move every once in a while, try someplace new. So we're looking at the Midwest, maybe as a change. And
some country.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think about getting a teaching position, teaching poetry at some sweet little liberal arts college somewhere would be really great. So as I continue to get the publishing credentials, that's when you can start to realistically apply for teaching positions in creative writing.
And the MFA, thank the Lord, the terminal degrees, where for me to have a full-time position, I'd need a doctorate, which I have two masters, and as a professional friend of mine said, 22 masters don't make one PhD.
Yes.
But the
MFA is no longer... It's no longer a terminal degree now that they have PhD in creative writing programs. So things have changed.
But the MFA in poetry that you have and in creative writing should be still. So.
Yeah, although it's gotten so competitive now. And because there are all of these PhD in creative writing programs cropping up, that is increasingly being looked for when you go to seek those professorship positions.
Yeah. We've covered a lot, the basis tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Sonya Greenfield?
Well, I really love dogs. I'm crazy for dogs. And I'd like to spend as many days at the dog park as I am allowed. And I don't really get to watch television, not because I think there's anything wrong with it, but it's not what I choose to do, because my preferred activity is I'm plowing through the New York Times crossword puzzles using the app on my phone. And lately, I've been falling asleep at night while I'm reading The New Yorker, and so my husband will walk in the bedroom with the magazine open on my face and all the lights on in the house and me halfway through a magazine. So, and I really like beer. there you go. There's a hodgepodge of little things.
I am terribly allergic to dogs' hairs, and I had to get rid of a dog when I was 5 and a half, and it broke my heart. And I only found out about 10 years ago that I can have the kind of dogs that don't shed, and you spend much money to have them groomed. And we have this 12-pound silky terrier who, in addition to two cats in the house, just rules the roost, you know, and it's a tremendous thing when either there's one cat that stares at me the way the dog does, and there's just so much love there in their faces. Mm-hmm. It's just wonderful. Mm-hmm. So I'm an animal person. We feed groundhogs and chipmunks and deer and squirrels and whatever, but it's a I don't understand how there are some people that don't love animals, honestly.
I know. Well, some people, I've met some people who were scared by them when they were children, so they've been traumatized, and so they don't like animals because they're harboring a fear of animals. And then there are other people who I think are a little bit germophobic, who associate animals with dirtiness. And so, but my, I also know that, like, that those are really not my people. So.
Yeah, there were also people who don't like children either, but, you know, but I've got a couple of them, so.
There are those people as well.
Yeah. And as a bookend, would you take us off with another poem?
Yes. So this is in the chapbook American Parable. And it's, suppose he was yours who saw rust at first turn of the green wheel. Excuse me. I made a mistake. Let me start from the beginning, please.
Sure.
Suppose he was yours who saw rust at first turn of the green wheel handle, your yard slicked down, sprinklers ticking away, days meted out in trips to 7-Eleven and the community pool. Suppose he was yours who saw brown, waited for it to run clear, then drank down the whole metallic feel of it from the copper end of a hose, summer spread before him like a growing puddle. Suppose he was yours who bathed in the river of your tub, scratched until his skin oxidized, flaking off in his sheets. Suppose you saw pinpricks of his blood, but washed those sheets in the same water anyway. Suppose they said boil it, and you did, but that only made it worse. Suppose he was yours who was told his anger will fleck and spread unchecked, was told bits of heavy metal will dam his lobes. Suppose he was yours who was tested and told he will lose himself in a wash so sick everyone already knew you couldn't eat the fish caught there. Suppose he said, I'm just going to be stupid anyway. What would well up in you, and where would that poison run to?
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that from people, and you, and I remember one fellow telling me that he was the stupidest in our sixth grade class, and I said, "No, you weren't." And he said, "Yes, I was, because they sat us in the order of our report cards, and I had the seat by the door." And I just felt so. How could anyone have done anything like that? You know, just awful, awful.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Send any comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13 at gmail.com. And be sure to join us next week at the same time when I'm joined by Jane Hansen. Go to my website, www.johnmack13.com, for URLs of previous shows and the schedule of upcoming shows. And in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in a book. Until next time, I see Sandy only but see ya. Then let's go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library, starting now on Amazon Music.
Thank you again, Sonia, and good night, everybody.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.